The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome.
We're going to interrupt the summer break with something special, a new story that was just released on Energy File that you wrote, Peter.
Yeah, it's a story I'm really excited to share with others. It's fully written, posted on the energyfile.org website, and also the audio version, which I really love because it's like a radio play, is also posted on iTunes. Where can we find it?
You can find it on any podcast app, but hey, because you're tuning into this podcast, you're soon going to hear it. But I will tell you that Peter's stories, and you've got a number, I think there's 11 audio stories that talk about history, business lessons from history that are very applicable to today. So I suggest that you tune into all of those this summer. I know people have a little bit more spare time, and they're really fun stories. So we'll put a link in the show notes to some of the podcast apps that they're on.
Yeah, but let's talk about the story, which is called Reinventing the Wheel. It's a story about the McLaughlin Carriage Company, which was one of the largest makers of horse carriages throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century. And they did what we call today a pivot, a hard pivot, and one of the few horse and buggy companies that actually made it into the motor car world. And in fact, after a very successful multi-decade run in building carriages, eventually pivoted into cars and became General Motors Canada.
So being someone who follows energy in Canada, I had not heard this story. How did you learn about it?
Well, I hadn't heard of it either, but I'm always on the lookout for energy transition kind of stories. And I was wandering through Heritage Park, which, if you're not from Calgary, is one of our historical theme parks here, the largest in Canada, actually. And they have an extensive automobile collection. And if you go into what's called Gasoline Alley, which is a dedicated building full of antique vehicles and other artifacts relevant to transportation and automobiles, you will see side by side a McLaughlin top buggy, which is one of their premier buggies at the time, and immediately beside it, a McLaughlin Buick, as it was labeled, a vehicle right beside it. So you can see side by side how they actually did that transition from buggy to automobile. And that was several years ago, and I was intrigued enough to research it much deeper, find out the story, which really started in the 1850s when Robert McLaughlin immigrated to Canada from Ireland, set up the carriage company, and then the family did the pivot about 50 years later.
Right. Well, I imagine that was the birth of Canada's auto industry as well, right? It's created a huge industry that we all know about and we have a lot of economic benefits from.
The McLaughlin Carriage Company was in Oshawa. And as we know, the auto industry is all in that southern Ontario area now. And definitely that was one of the big impetuses to get our auto industry going.
Well, let's turn to the story and we hope you enjoy it, but hang on at the end because we're going to come back and discuss some of the learnings from the story.
Yeah, great. In an era of transition, companies must change. People must change. Hi, I'm Peter Terzakian. The story you're about to hear is Reinventing the Wheel from my Energy File project. This is the ultimate story of corporate change and adaptation to new realities. Enjoy.
Reinventing the Wheel by Peter Terzakian.
What a beauty,
Fergus thought, admiring the carriage wheel he was assembling. Putting down his sandpaper, he wiped sweat from his forehead.
Ready for lunch?
Came a voice from behind. Fergus turned to see Simon holding up their lunch buckets.
Sure thing.
Inseparable since they were boys, the two now worked together at the McLaughlin Carriage Company. Simon specialized in axles and wheel bearings, some sheet metal too. Fergus was passionate about woodworking. He loved nothing better than to cut, shape and sand a fresh piece of hemlock. Thankful for the break, Fergus pulled off his shop apron. The men made their way to the back of the factory and took their usual spots at the lunch table. It was a cloudless summer day in Oshawa, Ontario. Rays of sun shone through the dusty windows above. As usual, The noise from the factory floor hammered at their ears, an echoing cacophony of banging, sawing and hollering.
You won't believe what I heard this morning.
Simon ventured as he fumbled for his salami sandwich. While his co-worker tore a bite out of his own sandwich, Simon let a pause hang between them. He was nervous to tell Fergus. No one liked to hear gossip that might shake up their job, never mind their entire livelihood. But it was 1906 after all, and change was knocking on their door. Even Simon could see that. Unfazed by Simon's drama, Fergus took his time eyeing the biscuits in his lunchbox. Finally, he replied,
"Okay, tell me, what's going on?"
I'm thinking about the McLaughlin Carriage Company as I wander around Heritage Park, a living history museum in Calgary, Alberta. Stopping to admire McLaughlin's 1910 top buggy, the wood, the leather, the suspension, I recognize my kind of company, one with high standards. McLaughlin employees like Simon and Fergus were true craftspeople. The buggy is grand enough on its own, but it's the pairing with a 1918 McLaughlin Buick motor car that illustrates this company's exceptional transition from the paradigm of animal power to petroleum engines. First, let me back up a bit. The McLaughlin story starts with a hard-working fellow named Robert McLaughlin. He was the son of Irish immigrants who sailed across the Atlantic Ocean for a piece of land and the promise of a better life in Canada. In the 19th century, everyone arriving in the backwoods had to labour with their hands. Young Robert worked hard, felling trees to make room for crops near the village of Tyrone, Ontario. Yet it wasn't long before his wood chopping led to a passion for woodworking, and by his early 30s, to entrepreneurship. Robert started out crafting axe handles and built his first horse-drawn sled in 1867. Both items were mandatory for Canadian winters. A neighbour expressed interest in buying the sleigh, and long story short, Robert's small farm was soon transformed into a workshop for sleds and carriages. Within a couple of years, Robert had already outgrown the workshop, so he expanded his operation to a larger facility in nearby Enniskillen and formed the McLaughlin Carriage Company. Robert McLaughlin was in business, and it was a very successful business. The workshop evolved into a three-story manufacturing complex in Oshawa, filled with hundreds of employees.
"Well, what is it?"
Fergus mumbled through a mouthful of ham, lettuce and bread. Leaning forward, Simon chose his words carefully.
"It's no secret Sam's been trying out those horseless carriages called automobiles, right?"
"So what? He's the boss's son. Curious type. Probably just fooling around with toys."
Gazing out the window, he declared,
"I don't see it going anywhere."
"Okay, but listen, because I think it's getting serious. Apparently Sam met with some big shot at an American automobile company last week. He came back all fired up to make his own motor cars."
"That's news? I'm not surprised. He's been on about automobiles for a while now."
His left foot began tapping in agitation.
"All this talk about motor cars taking over the world is tiring. People still like horses."
"I know how you feel, but I saw some numbers in the newspaper last week. Something like 178 motor cars were registered in Ontario a couple years ago. It'll probably be over 1,000 soon enough. I tell you, people are buying these things."
Simon's babbling about numbers just added to Fergus's irritation.
"Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're loud, smoke-belching death traps. And Sam's old man thinks the same. Just look at the company's calendars."
"I've seen them, saying automobiles are unsafe and dirty and such."
Still trying to open his friend's mind, Simon cautiously suggested,
"Fergus, getting rid of carriages might take away the soul of what built the family company. But we gotta think the world is changing."
As if to punctuate his point, he took a big bite of his apple.
"Changing? Carriages aren't going anywhere. Certainly not McLaughlin carriages. Just yesterday, some guy in Toronto ordered 20 top buggies."
"You're right. Joe over in accounting once told me we made something like 14,000 in 04, but..."
"But what?"
"Well, it's just that if Sam has made up his mind... I don't know.
Simon shrugged. He could see there was no change in Fergus's beliefs. Sam had, in fact, made up his mind. In 1907, the McLaughlin Motor Car Company Limited was formed, and by 1908, the iconic carriage builder had entered the automobile business. This 1918 McLaughlin Buick I'm standing in front of at Heritage Park is a beautiful testament to the success of that pivot. Kneeling down, I take a closer look at the craftsmanship of the McLaughlin buggy and its engine-powered successor. Both have four wheels, but the step change in mobility is stunning. Here's a company that transitioned from the old world to the new without compromising its commitment to quality. I reflect on the rarity of an established company so successfully reinventing itself as it stood on the cusp of obsolescence. Sit in any boardroom these days and someone is guaranteed to declare, hell, we don't want to be another Kodak or Blockbuster Video. In this age of technological assault and serial disruption, lamenting corporate losers and declaring you'll avoid the same fate has become trite. The tough part is in the doing. Just ask anyone in the business of newspapers, entertainment, or retail. I marvel at those who lead through radical change and doubly admire those who become successful all over again. Technology is the easy part of advancing innovation. Mindset is the most difficult thing to change. With 100 years hindsight and a billion cars on the road, it's simple for an armchair analyst to declare that shifting from horseshoes to pistons was a natural move for the McLaughlins. But in the moment, rarely is anything so obvious. Entrenchment of the status quo in corporate culture is like family tradition, tricky to break. When a product has existed a long time and you're in the business of selling it, thinking outside the box is hard. To be sure, the horse and carriage box was really rigid. By the 19th century, human mobility was deeply embedded in our consciousness. This makes me think of a display of ancient Assyrian chariots I once saw at the British Museum. Dating back to the 9th century BCE, those stone carvings of people being pulled by horses are a reminder that the McLaughlins weren't building anything new. Robert and his sons were simply establishing a company in a business-as-usual paradigm. In fact, Bronze Age artifacts suggest that good old human know-how figured out how to roll stuff around on carts 5,000 years ago, shortly after the invention of the wheel. That's a lot of generations to ingrain a way of life and weld mental blocks into our DNA. I call them intransigence genes, strongly embedded beliefs that inhibit mental flexibility. In my experience, such genetic material is widespread in corporate culture, so I understand how workers like Fergus believed the animal-powered transportation model would never die. Even Robert McLaughlin himself was afflicted with the gene. Yet by the early 1900s, the wheels of change were accelerating. Animal power was on a fast trot out to pasture, and companies like McLaughlin had to pull their thinking out of the ruts. There was only one corporate survival plan: make a wide strategic turn by investing hard dollars into the automobile age. As I consider the buggy and the Buick in front of me, I imagine the uneasy discussions that must have taken place in the boardrooms of carriage makers back then. The wheel, and all that made it go round, had to be rethought. Most of all, corporate culture had to be rethought. A month after Simon shared his gossip with Fergus, the two had much to talk about on their morning walk to work. The McLaughlin Company had confirmed it would begin manufacturing motor cars alongside its carriages. Simon, always the chatty one, kindled the conversation.
I'm looking forward to working on automobiles,
he said. Then, remembering that yesterday's news would have shaken his friend, he added,
and you get to keep working on carriages.
Plodding along grudgingly, Fergus contemplated the factory as it came into view.
Yeah, I appreciate you're ready to move on, but I'm happy to stick to making carriages. People will want the pleasure of them for a long time. They're not going away.
No, not for a while anyway.
Simon granted. Despite Fergus's declaration, he could see his friend was starting to doubt himself.
Besides, motor car interiors are made with a lot of wood.
But Simon's words of consolation went into the ditch. Fergus didn't think of himself as just a carpenter. He was a proud carriage maker.
I don't see myself building those smoke-belching machines.
He snapped. Simon understood his friend's mood. Fergus was clinging to the idea that his job and the world would never change. He dropped the subject, and the men walked the rest of the way in silence. But the metalworker knew he was right. Carriages were a dead end. Fergus was being his usual obstinate self. Only this time, Simon worried that Fergus's close-mindedness might eventually lose him a job. 3 decades after Robert's first carriages were built, the automobile age had arrived, and the McLaughlin family business was about to be transformed. It started with another McLaughlin employee introducing Robert's 2 youngest sons, Samuel and George, to the allure of the automobile. Having inherited their father's entrepreneurial spirit, the brothers quickly grasped the incredible change that was afoot and began transforming McLaughlin operations to produce motor cars alongside their traditional offering. Sam was the main driver of the change. What's especially impressive to me is that at the time of its shift to automobiles, the McLaughlin Carriage Company was doing well. There wasn't an immediate financial incentive to shake things up. In fact, at its peak, McLaughlin claimed it ran the largest carriage works in the British Empire. Too often, the adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, is the default for corporate leaders. Yet the vehicles in front of me confirm that McLaughlin's management overcame any complacency and resistance that plagued it. The first point of resistance? Robert McLaughlin. Sam had a tough time convincing the man they called the governor that cars were anything more than a passing fad. As he says of his father in a 1954 Maclean's article, he honestly believed that the automobile would never replace the horse-drawn carriage, certainly not for many years, certainly not in his time. However, Sam didn't let Robert stop him. Here's how the new thinking evolved. Sam got his first whiff of change in 1904, when Oliver Heselwood, McLaughlin's bookkeeper and an early adopter of the automobile, asked Sam to make a custom top for his open-air car. He was so happy with the result that he invited Sam to drive the horseless contraption. Oliver had ulterior motives. He saw the great opportunity in getting McLaughlin into the car business and figured Sam was his best bet for making that happen. It worked. The young McLaughlin was duly amazed and later said, "From then on, I had a new kind of wheels in my head. Motor-driven wheels." In 1905, Sam started conversations with several American automakers, but it was a chance encounter with William Durant, head of the Buick Motor Company, that determined McLaughlin's path. After that meeting, Sam returned to Ontario and purchased a 2-cylinder Model F Buick. Impressed, he knew right away it was the car he wanted to make in Canada. Sam headed to Michigan to meet with Durant, who himself had once run a successful carriage business. But both men were stubborn. Negotiations reached an impasse, and they agreed to disagree on friendly terms. Back home, Sam expected his father to shut down his dreams. To his surprise, the governor told him, "If you think you can make a go of it, go ahead." Robert may have been intrigued by the rosy financials Sam had dug up on Buick. So, along with George, Sam prepared to design and produce pure McLaughlin badge cars in their new plant. And they almost did. They had all the parts ready for their first 100 cars, but close to launch, the company's engineer fell ill. Needing a replacement, Sam telegrammed Durant asking if he could lend them one of Buick's engineers. Instead, Durant himself showed up with two executives, interested in continuing the conversation from their previous meeting. They reached a deal in 5 minutes. The McLaughlin Carriage Company signed a 15-year agreement with the Buick Motor Company to use its engines in McLaughlin-built cars. Robert, as president, was the one to sign the contract, but by then, it seemed he'd come around to deeming automobiles a worthwhile sideline to the primary business. The first Buick-powered McLaughlin was completed in December 1907. In the first year, the Oshawa plant turned out 198 cars bearing the McLaughlin name, later to be called McLaughlin Buick. For 8 years, the company manufactured autos and carriages side by side, but the sales bias of petroleum vehicles was undeniable. In 1915, even though McLaughlin was still making a carriage every 10 minutes, Sam sold off all the company's buggies to its largest competitor. As Simon made his way to the old carriage factory, a wave of nostalgia overtook him. He hadn't been in that building since he moved over to the automobile shop all those years ago. The door was wide open. His former haunt looked desolate. McLaughlin had finally shut down its carriage operations, and equipment was being cleared out. Simon wandered to the area where suspension parts had been made for the top buggies. Reminiscing, he took off his gloves and ran his hand along a workbench, pitted with decades of tool marks. One by one, he opened its small drawers, searching for something he hoped hadn't been lost.
Please be here.
At the fifth drawer, he smiled.
Ah, here it is.
His worn copy of William Philipson's The Suspension of Carriages, its blue cover thick with dust. Flipping through the yellowed pages, Simon admired diagram after diagram of intricate designs. This 1889 beauty had once been like a Bible to him. Closing the cover, Simon pushed the book into the back pocket of his overalls. He knew he'd never use it again, but he wanted it for sentimental reasons.
All those years we spent poring over that book, and now you're on to a new kind of manual, eh?
Startled, Simon turned. Fergus was standing in the doorway, carriage parts stacked in his arms. The two rarely saw each other these days. Their friendship had drifted in step with the company's changes.
Fergus. Hi, Simon.
I'm sorry to hear about the carriage operation shutting down.
His old buddy shrugged in resignation.
I'm going with Tudhope.
You're moving to Orillia?
No, that plant makes ambulances for the war these days.
Fergus said.
I'm headed to Brockville. That's where we're sending all the carriage parts.
To emphasize his point, he lifted the load in his arms.
Gee, how many carriage companies has Jim Tudhope acquired?
At least four.
Fergus replied.
He's buying them all up.
And all these years on, you still get to make carriages.
Yes, sirree. Tudhope's focusing on building his carriage empire.
Said Fergus, perhaps a little too confidently. Both men knew Jim Tudhope had been trying to make a go of it as an automaker.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, my friend.
Simon smiled gently. He felt sorry for Fergus, going from one dead end to another. As he started for the door, the automaker had a thought. He reached into his pocket and pulled out the book.
Oh, here, Fergus. You'll have more use for this than I will.
Jim Tudhope was another player who dabbled in both carriages and cars. Earlier in the 1900s, he briefly manufactured motorized vehicles with help from American interests. But by 1913, his car division went bankrupt, and by the end of the First World War, he was out altogether. In 1924, he divested of his carriage business as well. Tudhope wasn't unique. Many companies tried to be automakers and failed. So it raises the question, why did McLaughlin flourish while so many others flopped? According to Sam McLaughlin himself, the partnership with an American manufacturer didn't guarantee success. In the 1954 Maclean's article, Sam says, "Even with the Buick connection, we had to be lucky to succeed. We just happened to pick a car that was destined to make good. Personally, I don't place much weight on luck or things just happening in business. I think the McLaughlins were savvy operators with a sense of urgency, while others, not so much. Tuthoop's demise in the automotive sector was the result of inefficient operations, high costs, and poor quality products. I've seen enough of that today. The formula for failure is a lot simpler to write than the one for success. It's been fun to consider the significance of McLaughlin's two vehicles. As I prepare to leave, I take one last look, contrasting the carriage harness to the automobile's gear selector. It's easy to assume much of the company's transition was about shifting from old technology to new. But the hardest thing to shift in an organization isn't its technology, product line, or manufacturing processes. It's the attitude of its leadership and employees. So, for me, the McLaughlin story is far more about the mindset of company leaders like Sam and employees like Simon. The ones who embrace change and help usher it in, or at least who can cut through their emotional attachments to the past and recognize a business opportunity when they see it. Even the governor came around. When Robert wrote to McLaughlin's agents to inform them the company was dropping its carriage business, he observed, "The invention of the gasoline engine and its adaption to vehicular travel is, in my judgment, at present working a revolution in the horse-drawn vehicle trade." Seems that intransigence gene had mutated. Driving away from Heritage Park, I'm inspired by what the McLaughlin Carriage Company accomplished. After 50 years in business, it changed its corporate culture. In doing so, a Canadian company also played a role in changing a 5,000-year-old paradigm in personal mobility. In 1918, 3 years after the carriage works was sold, and with the lucrative contract with Buick soon ending, the McLaughlins sold their motor car company to what is now General Motors Canada. Cars bearing the McLaughlin Buick name were produced until 1942. Sam remained president of General Motors until 1945 and was chair of the board until his passing in 1972, at the age of 100. From sleds to buggies to cars, the McLaughlin family led their company through a monumental era of change.
Thanks for listening. For more on this story, visit energyfile.org/reinventing. Reinventing the Wheel was written by me and edited by Laurie Burwash, with audio production by Bo Szyminski at Ear Candy, and voices by Barry Barnes, Tyrell Cruz, and Scott Roberts.
I hope, listeners, you enjoyed that. I know I did. And much of the discussion in this story really resonated with the conversations I'm involved with today. You know, lots of conversations about transitioning companies, definitely some denial, like, do these EVs even work?
Yeah, exactly.
I think I heard that one last week. Maybe some overexcitement about technology, like how high hydrogen stocks went earlier this year. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. Just a lot of things in that story just are so much like the conversations we have today.
Well, it's just, it's like a movie we've seen before. You know, they say past is prologue. And in many ways, the themes that were in this story in the very late 1800s, early 1900s, are almost exactly the type of things that we see today. Resistance to change, visionaries who saw the change coming. The change happens from top down in management, but there's resistance within the organization to change. And so, you know, what's really remarkable about this story is the fact that a company that was so successful in making carriages, at the peak they were making 14,000 carriages a year, as the story said, they didn't wait for the carriage business to wane before they actually jumped in to the auto business. And I think that's quite remarkable, because usually companies pivot, as we say today, when all the sales start to slow down and they're in trouble and they feel like, what do we do? But actually, by that time, it's too late.
Yeah, no, it takes a lot of foresight and vision to make that transition. I think it's very rare. I mean, you've seen other corporate examples, but they're very rare. And I think, you know, the people are so important. There were some quotes here that really caught my attention. Technology is the easy part of advancing innovation. Mindset is the most difficult thing to change. And another quote, entrenchment of the status quo in corporate culture is like family tradition, tricky to break. And it's funny because we spend a lot of time talking about technology and is the technology ready and are the economics ready? Like 90% of the conversation goes on that topic and not very much on the people issues. But, you know, your story really did highlight to me, and I believe it, that it is really all about the people.
It is about the people from the top down. And you have to have both the top and the bottom of the organization, right down to the workers in the floor, buy into the change. And that was really one of the big messages of the story. So if we go to the top, we had Robert McLaughlin, the patriarch who had started the company and passed the reins on to his two sons. Robert was reluctant to change, even put out advertisements suggesting that vehicles were dangerous and that horse and buggies are clean and the way to go going forward. But no, it was really Sam, his son, who pushed for the change. But even he wasn't really the visionary who sort of saw it. It was the accountant in the organization. And so to be able to, first of all, create that top level recognition that, wow, things are happening around us. We need to change. You know, today we see companies that are still not quite there. And it's, you know, it's not only in oil and gas and in energy, but in many other industries too. It's the same kind of thing. There's disruption about to come, then there's a denial, and then, you know, you ultimately have to succumb to the transition. But if you cut out the denial phase first, then you have much greater chance of being ahead of the curve. Then I wanted to pick up, and I sort of created the historical fiction of two factory workers, Simon and Fergus, because especially in large corporations, the organization, the people, the workers have to buy into the change too. And you'll find that there's a lot of entrenched attitudes that need to change. Those are the people that are going to make it happen.
Yeah. Well, some people are just more resistant to change than others.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I thought about, you know, it was very interesting, Sam, the son of the elder McLaughlin, was an important character to overcome that momentum of the status quo. And it wasn't easy. I mean, he tried a couple times, I think, to make different deals with GM or to go on their own. But how do companies identify and encourage these individuals at all levels of the organization? I think Simon was the other person that was a kind of a visionary. Because I think corporate culture tends to stifle these types of people. And the status quo, people reinforce that. And the person who steps up and says something controversial or different, you know, they're not necessarily encouraged to do that. How do companies encourage that?
Well, it's really paramount that they do and that the culture is put into place, especially if we think about today where everything is changing rapidly. Organizations have to be flexible. And to be flexible, people within organizations have to be allowed to brainstorm openly, if you will, bring about out-of-the-box ideas and thinkings, be able to monitor the changes, and the organization has to be flexible enough to adapt to new realities. I mean, we can take this to other industries that we've seen change dramatically recently. Like you go from VCR tapes to DVDs to streaming in the span of basically like 20 years, and companies that stick to the old paradigms, they're gone. Right.
Yeah. I mean, but how many really did pivot? I think most of them just were gone.
I mean, you know, Netflix was one that did pivot and saw it coming. And, you know, in a completely different industry of entertainment, they're somewhat an equivalent kind of story, but many didn't. And so, yes, you're right, Jackie. I mean, it's the whole, how does the organization as a whole have the latitude to change? It's not just, say, the workers want to change or the management wants to change. Everybody has to change to be able to move and make, like you take transportation, such an entrenched way of moving about. As I point out in the story, as I think about horse and buggies, it's a 5,000-year-old paradigm, you know, going back to chariots that had to be broken. I mean, it's so entrenched in the minds of people that, you know, how am I going to get from A to B? Well, it's a horse and buggy. It's been around for 5,000 years. So trying to think about changing that paradigm. And I tried to bring that out in Fergus, you know, who was sort of resistant to change.
Yeah. And I thought it was kind of interesting. You mentioned already the calendar that talked about all the safety issues with these cars. But it it also forgot the utility, right? Like, people were willing to take some risks to go places way faster and more economically than the horse and buggy.
So if you look at that calendar and the cover photo of the calendar, it's almost comical, right? There's a car that's crashed into the ditch, and there's sort of people around it that are struggling to survive or stand because they were in this accident in a car. It's unsafe. Meanwhile, in the background, there's people on bicycles and a horse and carriage sort of trotting by. So the message is, don't buy a car. It's unsafe. Continue buying the old modality because it's the way to go. Well, what do we hear today? Right? When you hear about all the criticisms of, say, electric vehicles and new paradigms of energy. Oh, well, it'll never stick. It'll never last. We got to stick to the old way. Well, we know how this story unfolded. So, but it is a standard response. It's a human response. So this is not an indictment more than an observation that people are resistant to change when they are challenged with new technologies and new processes and modalities, such as the onset of a new kind of vehicle. The first inclination is to say, no, I don't want to do that. Right. And that was sort of like the Fergus response. Whereas you will have the Simons who say, well, hey, wake up, buddy. Like, it's time to move on. And I'm going to retrain myself and move on.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes that's so entrenched in people's personalities. Mm-hmm. Another quote really caught my attention in that 1954 article. So Sam, after the fact, attributed the success to picking the winning car. Even with the Buick connection, we had to be lucky to succeed. We just happened to pick a car that was destined to make good. And you wrote, personally, I don't place much weight on luck or things just happening in business. I think the McLaughlins were savvy operators with a sense of urgency. So, you know, this comes to the right team too, because you talked about many carriage makers at the time at some point decided they needed to make this pivot as well, and they were unsuccessful.
Yeah.
So, you know, the team is really important as well.
The team is so important. And I'll double down on that quote that, you know, I'm not much of a believer in luck. It's really the savviness to be able to take advantage of opportunity that presents itself. And you have to have the right team of people to be able to do that. And that's what this company had and the mindset that they ultimately had to do it. Because there were others, and I point out in the story, Tud Hope and many other carriage makers, not only in Canada but around the world, that either tried to pivot or refused to pivot. And of course, they're no longer around.
Mm-hmm. And they also went all in. Like, you know, they sold the carriage company while it was still making money. But I imagine that enabled them to have the capital to accelerate their move into autos as well. Yeah. And so it takes a lot of belief, you know, and vision to kind of execute.
Absolutely.
A lot of people like to be conservative.
And again, you know, from a human, raw human perspective, it's emotionally hard to do that, especially when it's a family business, to say, I am going to give up on and sell the family business that we've been operating for almost 50 years. Like, that's a hard thing to do for any business, let alone a family business.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great story. And it's also just great, you know, a Canadian success story that seeded our auto manufacturing industry here in Canada.
Right. It's a really amazing story that I really enjoyed writing. So I hope people enjoy it.
Thanks for joining. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.